to Forge the Narrative.
Hey everybody, welcome to Forge the Narrative. My name is Paul Murphy, your host for the LOL Souls podcast. I'm joined tonight by Peter the Falcon, Baron of the Northern Waste, Architect of the Stats of All Things 40K, the Falcon Calissimo.
Ka-ka! Hey, thanks for having me.
And Adam the Game Camilleri.
Oh, hello everybody. Thank you for having me.
That's all I got.
Didn't quite measure up to the. I haven't got any. I'm not a counter or baron of everything, unfortunately.
You're working on it.
Yeah. I could be like count of 40K Australia or something, or
yeah,
down under baron, the down under prince. I don't know.
I think. How about the Duke of Down Under?
Ooh, that's it. That's the one. That's it right there.
We're going with that. You want me to start over?
No. Roll with it. You can't capture magic like that in a bottle twice, man.
No,
it's like lightning.
No.
It probably just peaked. I just blew. I'm going to have to do a lot of editing on that one. Gentlemen, thanks for joining me. We are hot off of our LVO experience, which was a little bit different than maybe some other people's and maybe even what we expected.
It was different from everyone's except for Reese and Frankie and the handful who did the G-Dub stream. And it was probably still pretty different from theirs as well.
if people haven't heard or checked it out, go to the 40K Stat Center Twitch stream, the 40K Stat Center Facebook, and listen to their show, the 40K Stat Center, I'm sure coming out pretty soon or next week, to see what we did.
Yeah, Val and I should be recording an episode next Monday or Tuesday whenever he himself gets back from Vegas. He's still parting it down pretty hard out there.
Living the life.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, it really felt like we did something special there. I know that, Paul, you were set to play in the event, as was I. But, man, from what we were able to accomplish, I'm pretty happy I didn't play. I was just going to get knocked out by some random Iron Hands player who went first anyway. So stuff it. Might as well do something special.
Well, so Val approached me. I don't know. You guys may have your own story about thinking about trying to put together a stream. Wanted to know if I'd be interested, and of course the answer was yes. You know, he makes the call. I'll answer that call. And then he started figuring out how to do it. You know, basically piecing together, I'm sure, help from folks, getting some other help. And Tony, who's not with us on this call, maybe try to get him in on, was him and Val are not present on this, but without them, it absolutely would not have been possible. And we can talk a little bit about that if you guys like. I don't know if you'll cover it on y'all's show. I don't want to steal the thunder about the process, but it was really pretty epic. A cohesive unit. I mean, functioning like a literal well-oiled machine to bring continuous 40K content coverage from the LVO. Not just one table, not just one group of players, but the whole dang thing.
Yeah, I suppose that's what sets us apart from many others. From Data Network, I've streamed probably close to like 15 to 20 events. And usually that stream is just us covering whatever we think is the best matchup of the round. Like if it's the top table in the final one or two rounds, then that's exactly what it is. But at the start and for the first couple of rounds, we just pick the best lineup, the best matchup. So let's say it's, you know, Craft World versus Chaos. That's usually a good matchup at the moment. You know, it can go either way. It's in the balance, especially if they're both good players. But you don't really get the scope or the depth of the field in there. And that's really what we tried to do with this one. And that was the brainchild of, Peter and Val bringing us together. I know when they asked me, I was like, it was a hard prospect to say no, especially with how well and what they said we were going to be doing. Because there were rounds where we covered literally 13 different tables, 13 different games. We had rolling coverage of each one. We had score updates from each one. We had all the pivotal moments and things to see. Like, it was incredible.
And I don't know if you guys have caught the coverage yet. Please check it out if you have not. But, you know, Adam and I were sitting next to each other. We could feed off each other. Peter, you were out there in the field, you know, basically kind of like on an island, but came in spot on every single time.
Let's say 75% of the time. There was a good one in every four times where I was like, there's like six mutant buttons on this camera. I think I've turned off three of them. And then you guys just get silence for a bit. But I mean, you know, for the most part, I would say for a first go, it went really, really well.
Well, I meant when you're slipping into the coverage, you know, essentially.
Oh, like yes, you just for sure.
Absolutely for sure. Spot on with it. Yeah, there were some technical things along the way. But I think, you know, I've actually gone back and listened and watched our content. And I think the good stuff, the continuous content, definitely outweighs what is obviously a learning experience for us.
And look, like you watch news coverage on CNN or whatever, and every like fifth or sixth cross they'll do to live someone, they'll stand there nodding with their finger in the earpiece for like a good 10 seconds before they launch. And, you know, even the pros get stuff wrong. They stuff up the switches. So I'm not even going to worry about that stuff. I think it was incredible that we were able to have the cojones to try and take something like that on.
For sure. No, I had a great time. And if you want to talk a little bit about it, I don't mind. I think Stat Center this coming week is going to be more focused on, you know, CanCon, LVO results, maybe a little bit on this. But the whole experience, it started, a little history. I reached out to Reese, 3 months ago, right after SoCal Open, and said, hey, would you like someone to help with your streaming for LVO? I know that GW does a lot of it, but I wouldn't mind giving a hand. And he said, sure. And then didn't hear much back. And then about a month and a half, 2 months later, Pablo reached out to me and said, hey, would you mind doing like Facebook Live updates for the event? I said, fine. Like, I guess I can do that. But I was kind of hoping for something more. And then Pablo reached out to Val and asked if he would help me with that. And Val and I got together. We started chatting with each other and we were like, well, if we're going to do this, we're not going to do it half. Pardon. Mm. Right. We're going to go all the way. So Val created this, came up with this kind of spreadsheet of ideas. We figured we needed a team. I said, I want Adam Camilleri if he's available. I know he's a little bummed about the meta right now and he's still planning on coming. And Val was like, well, what are your thoughts on Paul Murphy? Literally like a 3-second conversation. And I was like, well, I would love it. And we had our team. Tony came in late. Tony was, we'd been talking to him about it for, you know, weeks and weeks. He was helping us a lot with a lot of the back end stuff with Stat Center. And, of course, the great Pablo Martinez and Val, like 3 days before the LVO, were just like, Tony, just come. And he bought a ticket on the spot, like just from that little phrase, like, just come with us. Bought a ticket, flew out, and he was so pivotal to getting that all done because he was like the anchor between all of us. Mm. I would feed stuff to him over the headset. He would type it out, give it to you guys. He was doing articles for Frontline. Like, he was like the everyman in there.
The glue.
For and sure.
If people don't know, that's Tony the Babe Pierce.
No, he's Sir Panda Pants on Reddit. So he's actually a pretty prolific Reddit contributor. And so even if you don't know you've seen some of his stuff, you probably have.
Yeah, no, and he's a great guy. A little bit of a munchkin, shops at Gap Kids, but otherwise, built like an upside down triangle.
He's a beefcake, man. We got to get him on camera more.
He is. Yeah. He's definitely not meant to be on podcasts.
Between him and Val, they did the most amount of work for the least amount of recognition. And Paul, we could talk 40K all day, every day, and we would do it without any money, without getting our faces on the camera. And we would just do it anyway. Like, that's what we were chatting. Even if we weren't on camera right now and we weren't playing in LVO, we'd be standing next to the table talking the same shop as we are regardless.
One of the questions we get is, like, why do you do this? Like, well, we would be doing this anyway. We might as well turn the camera on.
Exactly.
It turns out, you know, hopefully some people thought it was worth watching because I've certainly had a phenomenal amount of feedback. And thank you to anybody and everybody who's actually given us feedback, positive or negative, because that's the only way this stuff gets better and the only way we feel like doing it again. Because what did we end up doing? Something like 30-something hours of coverage?
Something like that. And the chat was so supportive. Like, any time that we were a little bit off our game a bit, you know, leaving a mic on or out of focus or whatever, you could tell that it was just encouragement from the chat to let us know what's up so we could fix it. And that's a credit to, you know, everyone adjusted. Everyone was pivoting and doing whatever was required at the time. It was really special.
Absolutely. Especially is the right word as well, because this was, I'd never met any of these gen. I've met Val in the flesh once at ATC 2018, which he remembers with some shame because he says it's like one of the worst 40K weekends of his life. But yeah, I met him there. I'd met any of these gentlemen until I walked into Vegas. So that was pretty, I met Pete at Charity Hammer. Yeah.
Yeah. 2 weeks before you had my coat.
That's right.
Complained about it the whole
your
time.
Coat. So I brought a huge amount of models with me, guys, and very little clothing. Now I like to travel light. So I had zero available space for Pete's ridiculous, like, tip of Antarctic friggin' triple-layered jacket.
I don't know. We didn't clear this first. Do you need to address him as the Baron of the Northern Waste, the Tyrant of the Tundra? Are you supposed to do that every time?
As long as he calls me the Duke of Down Under, that's
okay.
Fine. but yeah, I had this jacket that just, I couldn't fit it. I had to, it was very hard. Every time I was packing my bag to move like places, because I traveled for all of January down the west coast of America. Every single time I packed my bag, I cursed Falcon like 6 or 7 times.
Blame Colin because I didn't want to wake him up. And so I just left it. And I missed that coat because I flew home from Charity Hammer. I was going to spend a week and a half home, and then I had to fly back to Vegas. When I landed, I drove 8 hours. As I was driving to my home, the temperature on my truck, the sensor, just kept going down and down. It was minus 2, which is, I don't know, like 30 some odd degrees Fahrenheit when I started my trip. And it was minus 45 Fahrenheit when I stopped it. And I had no coat.
45 Fahrenheit?
Yeah, minus 45 Fahrenheit. That was when I pulled in, I was like, well, I don't have a coat, so I really need to rush into the house immediately.
Before your internal organs freeze.
While I'm happy you didn't die, I am happy you're uncomfortable.
So we get there. What did we talk? We started setting up on Thursday, right?
Yes.
And you guys did the charity stream.
Yep, me and Adam with Mariana, the... Adam proclaimed intestines of frontline gaming. She didn't like that one.
No, she loved that. So many looks of kindness from Mariana. She was just beaming with joy.
Yeah. We did the charity stream with Alex Fennell and Mark Merrill. It was a great stream. I really enjoyed talking to the two of them after the game. Both guys are just super awesome. And I had a ball because Adam and I have commentated games before, but it was always remotely. So doing it side by side was a kick.
Then Friday, we get in there and we plan on firing everything back up again and like tragedy strikes.
Yes.
As I said, I've run a bunch of streams myself, and usually they're, compared to this, the streams that I run are extremely low tech, extremely low budget as well, which is why they're low tech. But for what I think the mental image of what Val wanted, I thought for the first like probably 4 hours, I thought he's trying to do too much. This is actually unattainable. And man, I was so happy to be proven wrong.
Well, nobody gave up during that period of time. I mean, this is exactly right. We're all, I mean, now granted, like me and you, Adam, were basically just like looky-loos, but I think we were cheering them on, you know, or whatever, and then just kept trying, you know, anytime, anything we were asked to do, we did, but a lot of the work was done by everybody else.
Yeah, we got to sit there and be divas and be like, oh, this is preposterous. powder my nose again, Tony. Tony, bring the powder.
We audible to do some kind of like halftime report things that are up on the Stat Center Facebook page.
And they were actually pretty cool. I actually enjoyed those a lot. I think they're pretty good as well.
Yeah, it was neat. You know, at least get that going to kind of whet people's appetite for maybe what was coming. And then we finally got everything up and going.
Yeah, when the tech support guy woke up.
Yeah. Wait, well, when was that? That was in the evening sometime, or
It was about 3 PM because BCP had its issue, which kind of gave us that extra time around that period, and that's when we got it back up. But it took us about an hour to retest everything, make sure it actually worked the way we wanted it to, and then we were good to go.
It was kind of fortuitous that there was that extra time at the tournament for us to.
Yeah, I think we were the only people that benefited from that. that storm of absolute crap for everybody else.
5 out of 800 people.
We were loving it. We're like, oh, yeah. Well, I loved it until about 11 p.m. And then I was like, why are we still here? I really want to go do something else.
And then at 11:45 when we wrapped off, we were like, okay, good.
Yeah.
Good.
Oh, we have to be here at 9 in the morning? Okay, great.
And knowing that we'd signed on to do the shadow round the next day, we're like, all right, so we're leaving here at midnight and we're going to be doing probably exactly the same thing the next day. I'm like, wow. That is a lot of talking.
I ended up doing 3 midnights in a row because on was it Thursday? Was it Friday night? I also did the GW preview for Frontline, and I was there till... It was Thursday night. So Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, I was there till forever.
Wow.
But that's kind of the tournament life, though. I mean, you don't necessarily mind it. It is still a break from the normal day-to-day. So I'm not complaining by any stretch, and I know you guys aren't either, but it was just that's what it took. We were there. We did do that third round, and then we kicked off again at 8:30 in the morning. And this content is up. Like, go to the Twitch channel. There's no current way to sub because the channel is so new, but it is up for your viewing. And so you could pretty much maybe, you know, fill your work week with the recaps or the coverage from the event.
For sure. There's a lot of really good stuff in there. And Val kept cutting away whenever I was saying mean things about Adam, other than the first time. So that guy.
Good.
Well, good news is we think there's going to be more coming.
Yes. Yeah, we're in talks with a couple of groups and amongst ourselves. We all want to do it again, I assume. Based on our talks, I think we all are keen on getting the gang back together for at least a couple more runs. We won't go into the details on exactly who we've been talking to, but it's some pretty big tournaments that have expressed interest in having us come out. And with better technology, Val and I have made a couple of really good contacts that I think will make it even better than LVO ever could have been.
That was one of the neatest things, and I even learned some stuff for this show, was people were coming in that were actually professionals in the field of audio and video.
Yeah,
and they really share their comments,
and they helped a lot, especially when we were down, having guys like Bridger, Tyler, AG, just come in and kind of double check all of our stuff, make sure that what we were doing seemed correct. I think it helped Val a little bit because, I mean, he was definitely sweating there, thinking that, we'd wasted all this time and money for nothing. Luckily, of course, it was just the server. Just that guy had to get off his Japan time and reboot it for us and make everything beautiful again.
And Val stayed head down the entire time. Absolute no quit attitude to get us up and running, And that's kind of what the neat thing is. Like, every person on the team seemed to feel like an obligation to the rest of the team to do their absolute best. And it was,
for sure.
I loved it. Good times. Thanks a lot, guys, for making it cool.
Oh, thank you for accepting our offer to come and just making it that much better.
The indecent proposal.
The indecent proposal. Because I will say, like, you two really, and I mean, this is quite the little circle we're having going on here, but you two really destroyed it. Every time I got a chance to hear you guys talk, when I'd run into the room to swap out a battery or whatever, it was just ingenious. The interviews you guys did, some of those are some of the best 40K talk I think I've heard in years. So
yeah, we're able to get those. We should see if we can get those clipped out into something else, like into their own form.
I think that would be great.
Some folks already have on Twitch. So it turns out there's a feature where people can clip things, and they have clipped, I think you can like 30, 45 seconds or whatever, but they've clipped out things that are important to them. There has to be a way to get it.
Except for that really good stuff.
Was hitting the source heavily by that point.
He was. I mean, he did suffer a pretty brutal loss and then a pretty brutal draw, and then decided that Vegas was going to be a little more memorable by not being able to remember it. But I mean, that being said, when he came in for that interview after me trying to make it not happen, there came a point where he sat down and I couldn't even believe he could walk. And he started talking with Adam Abramowitz about the Brad Chester Richard Siegler final game that was that had just started, and it was like how that guy can sit down, like barely be able to talk, and then have such an intellectual conversation about the game of Warhammer, like as if nothing had happened. It blows my mind. The guy, like, he sat down, he was slurring his words, he was waving back and forth, and then Adam was like, what do you think about the game? And it was just like, whatever part of his brain was drunk shut off, and it was just dead serious. He was going through, like, all of his thoughts on the game, strategy, and I was sitting there, oh my goodness, where did this come from? Like,
so he's like a dolphin, yeah? You know, dolphins only sleep with half of their brains at a time. Maybe only half of his brain gets drunk.
Yep, and then the other half is Warhammer.
Yeah, the other half is Warhammer. So he's got two halves of his brain. There's Nick Nardavati and then there's Warhammer.
That's an interesting dolphin fact that I did not know.
It's an interesting Nick Nardavati fact.
It's now a variety program. Unfortunately, it's not just Warhammer now. It's a variety.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the event. Hey, I got a hot take for you. Iron Hands are pretty good.
What?
Whoa. Breaking my mind here.
Now, okay, that's nothing that no one didn't know, right? But what made it even, better was that the Brohammer guys came in with a list that nobody'd ever seen, with some tech that no one else had cracked yet.
Well, there was a lot of assumptions going into this event that Imperial Fist would push out, would be the balancer, the other side of the coin to Iron Hands and kind of keep them in check. And that really wasn't the case because of the list that these guys took, because it pivoted around stupidly hard to engage infantry.
Yes. With essentially only one targetable vehicle that could push wounds off onto that stupidly hard to kill infantry.
Yeah, exactly right. And so it all functioned as a, do we have that list available? We can just run it down for the people and then just break it down about how it works.
I mean, I can go through the cores without really looking. It was, because I had to type it out about, nine times. It was, it was Iron Father Pharos, a, apothecary lieutenant, Primaris lieutenant because of the extra wound. I believe they all ran 40 intercessors. And each Intercessor squad had a Thunder Hammer or a Power Fist in it, just for that extra punch. And then they would have the Leviathan Dread and three Chaplain Dreadnoughts, and then nine Eliminators. That was like the core of the list.
Now, breaking that down a little bit further, they had the Super Apothecary for the 5+ Feel No Pain. That's correct, yeah?
Yes, the six-inch bubble, and then Pharaoh's giving the 5+ invuln as a bubble.
Mm. And now, breaking that down even further, they had 2 units of 10 Intercessors and 4 units of 5, yeah?
Correct.
And the 2 units of 10 they turned into Indominus Crusaders?
Yes.
So the reason for that is because they become legit counter-attack units at that point, because they get to 3 damage each, 4 on the charge, 5 on the... so they start with 2... No, sorry, 4 on the charge.
And, yeah, attacks, 5, it's not damage, yeah, but yes.
Yeah, and 5 on the sergeants. And the sergeants were all wielding, I think, Thunderhammers and Fists?
Yes.
See, that's...
So it's actually...
When
actually
I saw
scary
that,
to engage.
Yeah, when I saw the Thunderhammers and the Power Fists in the list, I'm like, what? That's the only thing that confused me. You know, and it was then when I think we had... It was John Lennon on. He was like, this is a list that's secretly a melee powerhouse.
Yeah, I think that was demonstrated best against Sean Naden. Sean Naden Siegler forced his hand, took the middle of the board, and Naden was going to lose unless he did something drastic. He pushed both his units of Shining Spears into the Intercessors, and they did okay damage, but as long as he's got the sergeants left, he could just smash them back, and he did. Like, we tuned into that game, Paul, and we saw like 6 of 7 Shining Spears just being picked up by Intercessors.
Yeah, they hit like a truck, and they have so many attacks. I mean, there's a reason there were more than 5,000 Intercessors at LVO. There were more Intercessors than any other unit.
Like, 5,000 or 500?
5,000.
5,000?
Yes. It was like last year there were about that many infantry units, Astra Militarum Infantry. This year, the number one unit was Intercessors. And it was like, I have it here, it was about 5,050. Intercessors. So there were more Intercessors than there were Guardsmen, Chaos Cultists.
Probably more than Hormagaunts.
Oh, yeah. Way more than Hormagaunts, Termagaunts, Gene Stealers. I mean, it was a pretty big heyday for Intercessors. And it's a 2-wound model. I know there was a time pre-Marine Codex where people thought they're pretty easy to kill, but with all the extra buffs they're getting, particularly like the Feel No Pain buffs they can get, the invuln saves, and the fact that people are building towards killing vehicles, it's actually a little bit easier for these Intercessors to stick on the board a little bit longer than they would have in the past.
Mm, I agree. I think Intercessors, well, the how flexible you can make that unit by all the different layers of buffs you can put on. There's a bunch of different stratagems to make whatever gun you've taken on them a lot better. On top of that, there are all these like things like transhuman physiology, gene wrought might, the Grey Shield, which I think is that's another layer of that list that we didn't talk about.
Yes.
So he's Grey Shielded the Indominus Crusaders, all the Intercessor portions. So for one turn of the game, they can become White Scars. If you're locked in combat with another, say in the mirror match, you can turn into Ultramarines, fall back and shoot. You can do all sorts of different things.
And the White Scars one was what blew away the Warhammer TV chat, I remember, when he did that. People were like, he's cheating, he advanced and charged when Siegler did it, but it was just because he popped White Scars. In the game against Brad Chester, he popped Salamanders to ignore the AP-1 on those Centurions when they dropped.
That's huge, actually. Big play.
So like it's such a like a malleable army when it's built that way, and it's so hard to kill. I mean, we focused on that John Lennon Manny Chima match for like a good half hour, because after round 3, I believe Lennon had 0 Intercessors left because Chima's list is designed to kill that stuff, and he then just refused to lose a model for 3 full rounds because of that. Cogitated martyrdom on the Leviathan to Pharos, healing Pharos, the Pharos healing the Leviathan, rinse and repeat round after round, and Manny couldn't get through it. He just could not put through the damage.
Yeah, he said it got a bit frustrating, and you can easily imagine that, because his list was an absolute powerhouse of a thing, an absolute destroyer.
Yes.
And yet he couldn't push through 14 wounds onto the Leviathan, even though he's quite capable of picking up almost 3 knights in a turn.
Yeah, early round closeouts, too.
Turns.
Yeah, I mean, just getting his games over in 2 or 3 turns, and then you run into something that they're doing these wound manipulation. That's really what it is. It's like passing things off, healing what got passed off to, then that guy healing anything that didn't get passed off. I mean, you do all this work, and then 4 wounds, 8 wounds that you did are just erased.
Yeah.
Well, it reminds me of 5th edition Grey Knights. You had the Paladin Star. It was only about 8 models in the Paladin Star, but they could all shift wounds onto each other because of the way wound allocation was back then. This is very much like what that is, where you have the control of the wound pool, your opponent doesn't. So it's not like your opponent can sit there and go, okay, take these wounds first. It doesn't even matter. They get to put them where they like almost, just due to the how many layers of saves you get, and then a bunch of different stratagems.
I really enjoyed that lookout sir stuff back then.
I did too. It was really fun.
Not even sarcastic. I was a Paladin player. I was.
Of course you were. You're no one is surprised, Paul.
You're the reason why a lot of people dislike that game, I think.
So Terminators are cool. Hey, how are you going to like spend all these episodes talking about how cool Terminators are and then turn on me when I mention that I played Terminators?
That's fair. I was playing the Leaf Blower regardless, so I can't talk anymore.
No, you're both awful.
Quite you. I was playing fantasy more anyway.
Me too. But I did play Space Wolves in 5th edition, so a lot of people hated me too.
Hey, anyway. You shut up as well, man.
Alarming number of intercessors. Do you happen to have like some of the stats on like the other Primaris stuff? Like, cause I saw a lot of suppressors on people's
lists. I did lie. I just brought up the thing. It was only 3,105 intercessors that were there. Sorry.
That's still not even a real number. Like, that's... Yeah. Crazy to think about.
The next highest was Chaos Cultist models at 2,518. Those intercessor squads, the armies they were in had a win rate of 58.78%. So people that brought them did well. I mean, Marines in general did well. The average Marine had like about a 61% win rate, Marine player, period. So they're getting dropped down a little bit by the people running Space Wolves and Blood Angels that took them because they didn't do as well. Eliminators, I had said pre-LVO when I had the initial list before people dropped and we had a few late signups, it was just over 600. There at the final total was 591 eliminators showed up at LVO.
That's probably held down by the fact they can only get squads of three and they're an elite choice.
Oh, for sure are. A lot of people probably take more. Thunderfire cannons, the final total was 321. And only 8 of them were pulled. I know there was a lot of talk about Thunderfires and Chaplain Dreads getting pulled if they weren't modeled appropriately. According to my sources in the judges' table, 8 Thunderfires got pulled over the event for being modeled incorrectly.
What is it? So Thunderfires won what, like 16, 20% of the lists?
Yeah, 181 lists ran Thunderfire cannons. So, and that's of it. The final total for LVO of different lists was 752. So, of all the lists, not just like Space Marine lists, which were the only ones that could take them, it was basically just under a third, or well, just about a quarter of the lists had a Thunderfire cannon. Period.
Well, they're good. They're very good.
Yeah, they do work.
If there was any doubt in anybody's mind before, I think that's pretty empirical.
Every time I do this, I always pull out Smash Captains out of the regular captain pool. So Thunderhammer, Storm Shield Captains, just because it's always cute. I remember the first LVO that I tracked it, there was something like, 240 Smash Captains, more captains than there are in all of the Adeptus Astartes. This time they topped out at 112. So not as crazy, but they were still out in force. 85 Tech Marines.
I'm sorry, that's more than just Blood Angels ones now, isn't it? Because regular Marines are quite capable of building them themselves, especially with the 4 damage Thunder Hammers and such.
Yes, or 5 if you play tricks.
If you're White Scars. Yeah.
511 Infiltrators, which I was a little surprised about because they hadn't been seeing a ton of play up until recently, and then there was a lot of lists.
You think people were bringing them in for that deployment shenanigan denial because they get the 12-inch bubble too, right?
You got it. I think a little bit was that, especially with Blood Angels just coming out, and there were a couple named players, at least one, like Steven Vox, was bringing Blood Angels, so it's something you need to worry about.
I was such – I mean, of course Blood Angels, right? But in the hands of capable players, I want to see what they did. I was trying to live vicariously for a little bit, but it just seemed like you ran out of gas.
Well, he had a bad Alex opening McDougal. Matchup. Yeah, Alex McDougal. 433 Assault Centurions, so they were definitely around. There were more Assault Centurions than there were Gene Stealers. 62 Leviathan Dreads, 383 Suppressors. Yeah, there's a lot of stuff.
I didn't expect to see, you know, I guess anecdotally, I don't even know what I'm basing this on, other than the fact that not every chapter can really benefit from the suppressors, I don't think. I didn't expect to see as many as I did. Maybe I'm wrong on that. Obviously, I'm wrong. But.
Well, there were just under 100 Iron Hands players at the event. And Iron Hands do make good work of those suppressors. So even if, you know, 40 or 50 lists brought them, they'll bring all 9 that they can fit into the list.
Yeah.
I was about to say, you're already into the hundreds.
The only two armies that I think can really effectively make use of suppressors is Ultramarines and Iron Hands.
For sure.
But yeah, I was really surprised to hear that number. So I would have thought they wouldn't, because I see the suppressors and the grav bomb and a few other bits and pieces as really being the utility you stick onto your really like flexible solid core of that army, and that being things like 30 to 60 intercessors with the Leviathan Dread and the character dreads and all those other things, and the little tech pieces you chuck on. But yeah, I'm surprised too many people went with suppressors.
Seems like they compete for other points. You know, that's basically what it seems like to me.
Do you have the number of drop pods?
Yes, I do. 46 in 42 lists.
I was about to say, in how many lists? Yeah, so there's only 4 people who took more than 1 drop pod in a list. That's pretty funny. Out of max.
I think there's just better ways to scratch that, too. I'm not a fan of the drop grav or whatever.
The drop grav, like, it does work once, and then you just have to hope that whatever it did work on can't now hold onto the drop pod for dear life, right? So.
Well, that's always been my issue with it. I feel like it's very good at beating players that aren't equipped to cope to deal with the pod, but it can be exposed by players with the right tools or good players. Like, I always think it's a unit. So there's, I think it's a term in Australia, and I'm not quite sure if this is an appropriate term to use. We call it scrub stomping. It's beating players you're always probably going to beat with your skill set, with your talents, with your list. And I feel like a drop pod is good at winning games you're probably always going to win. Like if a grav pod is a good unit in that matchup, you're probably going to win it anyway. If that makes sense?
It does. I see what you're saying. Yeah.
Yeah. The term, the scrub stomping term isn't a very endearing one. I'll agree with that. But Australians, we're not that endearing, are we? But
it doesn't strike me as particularly offensive. I don't know if I've
definitely heard far worse. When you said that this might be offensive and you're an Australian,
I was like clenching, like, gone. What am I going to have to edit? What on earth?
But yeah, it's that concept of, plan for the worst. So plan for the best, outplay the rest. So if you like plan for the people you find it hard to play against, the list you struggle against, don't plan for the ones where like you're probably gonna have an easy matchup. There's no need to. You're gonna have an easy matchup. Like, so yeah.
Absolutely agree. How many knights were? I mean, I know I won't just bore you with all the numbers or whatever, but I saw, like, maybe it was just because my eye was picking them up, but I saw just what seemed to be a pretty monumental number of knights. Yeah.
Holy crap. I had no idea. I'd never, in all my wildest dreams, I was like, there's no way there's going to be a ton of knights because of Assault Centurions and Imperial Fists. Like, knights just won't be a thing. But no, there was tons.
Yeah, there was definitely a good amount. I'll give you the number here right quick because it only takes a quick filter. Well, let's see. Knight Despoilers were the big ones this year. Last year it was the Castellan and the Armagers. So there were 84 Knight Despoilers, 54 Crusaders, 22 Gallants. The Death of the Castellan shows here only 17 versus the like 97 that were at LVO last year. 7 Wardens, 6 Castigators, and then just, you know, a little one or two of the rest. There was 211 Knights in total.
That's
at the event.
Pretty good amount.
Yeah, I mean, it's nothing like what it was last year when they made up, you know, if you counted like secondary detachments, you know, like 20% of the meta. But yeah, they're definitely still around.
But wasn't that 20% just Castellans, though?
I mean, it was a mix. It was mostly Castellans, yes. There were like, you know, like 90 of those 97, there was 96 lists, right? So, you know, that's one in six players had a Castellan in their list last year at LVO, so.
I'd be very keen to see the breakdown of the weapons choices on the Despoilers, whether they were double thermal, double Gatling, a mix of the two, the double rapid fires. I find that interesting because then you find what people are really keyed in, because that's the most flexible of all the knight options.
For sure.
You'd be keying in on exactly what people think are threatening.
Just seemed like, again, maybe just because of the size of them, but it's like every other table seemed to have some knight. You couldn't go a few tables without seeing somebody with trip knights. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, I mean, of course, they look cool, but I just didn't expect to see that many.
And we know that a few people got exposed, like Nick Nanavati being one of them, got exposed because he just did not really factor in the need to kill, be able to shoot down a knight a turn.
I think with him it was more Magnus and Morty.
Well, that too. But right. Being able to shoot down a Knight a turn usually covers Magnus and Morty as well.
For sure. Yeah.
Most armies can take Magnus and Morty, I think. Now, if you don't, then you're in trouble. But like, you know, I think there's kind of a world of difference between that T7, T8 type threshold.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that was an interesting matchup.
Yeah. Well, yeah. But that's another thing about the LVO. It's so deep in drama and intrigue. There's all the big names from across, sometimes, you know, in many cases, the world have gathered at this one place. And there are so many narratives and so many things to be intrigued by. I mean, last year, like from outside of the US, we had Alex Harrison, who almost went all the way. This year we have, was it Boris Michev, who made the top eight from outside America? Was there anyone else in the top eight from outside the States? I'm not sure.
Sean Naden may be from another planet.
Yeah, it's a true story.
He's certainly not of this plane of existence. We can agree with that.
And you know, Richard Siegler, you know, maybe a 40K supercomputer. I don't know what his nationality is.
Well, I do love talking to Siegler because during that final, and even the semifinal with Siegler early on, there was a lot of talk like he's playing too conservative. He's going to lose because in the semifinal against Sean Naden, Sean took ground control and engineers, and Siegler went all killy secondary objectives. And with those two giant ruins on the board, a lot of people were like, well, I don't know if Siegler's going to be able to win this because Sean can just hide behind that ruin. And Sean kept playing that off on him, right? He was constantly like, do you just want to call it now? Like every couple rounds, because Siegler had to push out. But once he pushed out and got that first kill, Sean was on the back foot. So like he's such a cagey player. He knows how to play that game. And against Chester, I would say that 90% of the people that I was talking to as that game progressed thought he took too long to come out of his deployment zone.
Even he did.
For sure.
Well, I was interviewed Nanavati on stream. We were both like, I think he's cooked. I think he's waited one turn too long to move out. And even when he came in and interviewed with us, he said the same thing. He said, like, I think I probably waited one turn too long. I was more afraid of that last unit of Centurions than I needed to be, because he said when the first one came in and he used the Salamanders, I don't think he took anywhere near as many casualties as he was accounted for in his head. And he's like, I just kind of bounced it off due to Salamanders. And that meant he probably could have moved up that turn rather than waiting for turn three for the last unit to come down before he made his move. But the dude paced that game perfectly. Like, and he paced the game against Sean Naden as well. And here's the thing, like, he's very methodical. He's extremely technically sound. And he knows exactly, he seems to know exactly the moves he needs to make when he needs to make them. Like, it's almost like you need to do some very erratic, very nonsensical things to rattle him from, like, his predicted calculations.
He earned every bit of the championship, every bit of the tournament championship, you know, every bit. I mean, it's amazing play.
Yeah, incredible. Like, I honestly thought the top table game was going to be a non-event because he waited until turn three to even move from his deployment zone. And I thought, the game's actually over. And I was really happy to be wrong, because that would have been a very glorious way of ending what was, up until that point, an absolutely magnificent event.
In our slight defense, we were watching the game on a monitor that didn't have the best resolution.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we're looking at it and we didn't see how he was picking up a couple of points. Like, when the score ticked up in that one round, like, what on earth? At least in the back of my head, I didn't see any of those kill points. What on earth is happening?
Exactly, yeah, right. I was sitting here doing the math in my head about the things I was seeing going down. I was like, there's no way Siegler can stay in touch on points. And Chester's just going to pull ahead by one point a turn every turn until the end. But I didn't see all those little kills he picked up here, there, and everywhere.
I think the big one was and Chester even said it at the end. It was, I believe, an incursor squad that he had kind of just poked out from behind a wall that Siegler got line of sight on, and just like immediately picked up and deleted. Like, there was no thought there. And that to Chester, that was a big turn, because that was a 2-point swing. Yep. And that was when he tied it up 7-7, when a lot of people thought it'd be like 7-3, 7-4 by the time that turn finished.
Well, he said he picked that up with just eliminators. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, and that's another thing. Like, a lot of people, we talked a little bit about them already. A lot of people kind of discounted eliminators coming into this event. And then all the Brohammer guys took 9 of them, and they did work. I know that talking to like John and them, a lot of it is the psychology of them. But even then, the couple wounds they plink off, it gets you that kill when you're just sitting there waiting for your opponent to make a move. So
Exactly right. Well, I rate them a lot. I remember John Lennon said in his interview, like, I don't know what's the deal with them. He said he took them over things like the drop pod with the grab devs and the suppressors because they shore up a lot of the issues with the chaos game. They said there were some issues in the chaos game. The possessed get in, they can kill, you know, 30-odd intercessors in a turn, and the smites can eventually kill the Leviathan, things like this. And they said, but putting the eliminators on the board, I mean, they can't be cavalier with all those little support characters for the possessed, that master possession. He only has four or five wounds. He's very easy to snipe out. Same as like the Dark Apostle and the little and things like this. So it really changes the matchup there. And like you said, the psychological effect of them, the fact that you actually change the way your opponent wants to play the game, that can't be understated about how important that is.
Yeah, for sure. For a 72-point unit, really wouldn't.
Exactly right. They're not expensive. Like you're paying, what was 72 times, like times three is 116 points, 216 points.
Yeah, as a real talk, I'm putting together some more eliminators.
Sorry. Yeah, 216 points. Yeah, I've got nine eliminators. Yeah, 216 points to automatically rattle your opponent. Man, yeah. I'd pay like 8 CP to rattle my opponent at the start of the game. 8 CP, you are rattled for the next six turns.
Yeah. Guys, let's take a quick break. I may have a tournament spotlight segment to insert here. See how that goes. If I do, then it'll be me coming back with somebody else. If I don't, then it'll be me coming back with these guys. But regardless, after whatever comes next, you're going to talk to us again. See you all in a minute.
Bye-bye.
FTN is brought to you by Discount Games, Inc. Please visit them at www.discountgamesinc.com. And don't forget to ask Jay about ways to save even more on your hobby projects.
Hey everybody, welcome to a tournament spotlight segment on Forged Narrative. I'm Paul. I'm joined tonight by Nate Goodfellow.
How you doing, Paul?
Yo, man, thanks for joining me.
Oh, thank you for having me.
You were here to talk about the Dallas Open.
Yes, I am. The Dallas Open, it's going to be May 1st, 2nd, and 3rd. It's 3 days, but we're starting Friday on the 1300. That way, if you're looking to try to dodge taking that extra day off work, you can just take the red eye in. We're going to have two rounds on Friday, three on Saturday, and two more on Sunday to make it a seventh-round event.
Oh, wow. That's pretty good.
Yeah, 256 people. We've done the math. We'll still possibly have two undefeated, but we wanted to make it to where everyone can get in easily and get home easily without making weird flight arrangements.
Oh, I think that's very, very nice and something people would like to know that is considered.
Oh, yeah. Some of our local players tell us whenever we make scheduling errors.
Well, sometimes, you know, whatever. People like to cut it down to the wire. And if people are coming in from different places of the country, sometimes, again, that's just pretty cool. You've been doing this for a couple of years, right?
This will be our third year, yeah.
And I think your first year, you said you had a little bit over 70 people?
We did. We were in, I can't remember which hotel it was, but there you go. Hall was all glass windows on three sides right next to a really fancy country club, golf resort. So we kind of felt like monkeys in an exhibit. You had all these people in polos and flax just looking at us like we were crazy, all these guys and little toy models on the table.
And then you almost doubled it for the next year.
Right. Then we did the Grapevine Convention Center just south of where the Warhammer Citadel is, actually. And we had 123 people plus a narrative and a bolt action event.
I'd forgotten about the Citadel being right there. I mean, that's another thing, another attraction to maybe people want to check out when they come to your tournament.
Yeah, it's not going to be quite walkable like it was the last location, but this time we're in a hotel again. You can stay there. You get a discount on your ticket, you get a discount on the room. And it's not a short, it's a pretty short trip over to go see the Citadel, which is pretty amazing to see.
No, people can Uber down and whatever.
Oh, yeah.
Get a nerd themed coffee and a pastry item.
All I've had is the lemon rust tea, because when I started playing, it was Space Wolves or Bust for me.
Nice, nice. So what hotel is this thing at?
It's going to be at the Sheraton DFW, which is just northeast of the airport, and they have a Citadel.
So people can find out some information, then go to the dallasopen.org.
Correct. And if they have any questions, their contact information is there. We also have a Facebook page, which I keep track of messages regularly. So just send me a message, and I will answer your question as soon as I can.
You guys are using a homegrown mission set.
We are. So our missions are based around, instead of the primaries for ITC of hold more, kill more, we do hold more at player turn, and then kill on an objective. And then secondaries are locked in based on each mission, along with deployments are standardized. All missions are five objectives, with both players placing two in set areas and one always in the center.
Now, I know you guys are still kind of refining these missions, but they'll be up for download and for people to view and get an idea.
We're going to send out a whole PDF with thanking all of our sponsors, you know, telling you to please do the same with your money. All the missions, all the questions you could have, score sheets, and everything will be prim and proper and ready to go for the Dallas Open.
You'll have it up on your website pretty soon, right?
Probably. I actually was thinking of just saying it to the players, but like I told you in our pre-interview, I'm going to have the Art of War review them before I send them up, and I'll probably put them up right after that.
I think that would be great, especially the folks that that are considering registering. I really believe that most people like to have a good idea if they think the tournament's going to be great for them. So as much information as you – I always counsel folks, as much information as you can get out.
You're right. Created them just because a lot of new players we've been getting in Dallas were ITC scared them, like the whole picking secondaries. So I just built secondaries and missions.
That's absolutely cool, man. I think the variety is absolutely something that people will appreciate. And also, you got to cater to the folks that are kind of in your area or to people that may be looking for something a little different.
Yeah, and that's what we're hoping to do. We originally had a little bit of a backdraft because people are like, oh, if it's not, they get confused. It's not ATC missions. Is it ITC scoring? Do I get points for this?
Well, that's one of the beauty things about the ITC. As long as you know you submit your placings in their format, and everybody gets their points.
Yeah, and it's been a little bit of a hiccup to teach the players that they seem to think that ITC score means it all has to be just like an FLG event.
Well, again, you know, I assume that are you going to be submitting to the ITC?
Oh, absolutely.
Well, there you go. That's case closed.
So did you, I wasn't getting able to watch the streams. I was at LVO. Did you cast all the games or just some of them?
You'll actually check us out on 40K Stat Center on the Twitch, where we cast several games pretty much for the entire weekend. We actually had some little technical difficulties on Friday, but once we got up and going, it was off to the races.
Well, everyone had a little technical difficulties on Friday.
Well, thankfully, they actually gave us a little bit more time to get some of our stuff worked out, but it was a good time. But yeah, but back to the Dallas Open. Are you prepared for that number of people? Because jumping up from 150 was your 123 or whatever to 256.
Yeah,
that is a bit of a investment as far as like terrain and maybe staff goes and stuff. Are you guys ready?
So we're doubling our judges this year. Some of the judges have been, most of the guys I'm getting are the old players that have been playing for ages. They'll have a sheet on most of the common rulings. If the sheet doesn't answer, I have guys that are experienced that can get to the tables quickly that know what's going on. Terrain wise, we're only 60 tables short. Everything is designed. It's started to be built and I'm confident it will all be done because I'm doing probably 80% of it.
Well, hey, look, sometimes you just got to rely on yourself. So for the tickets, it looks like you may require a convention pass and a ticket. So is that the case?
It is. It's built into your tickets. The GT is $100. You do get a discount if you stay at the hotel, and lunch is included for Saturday and Sunday. So a lot of the costs you're normally planning for are already in the ticket.
That is pretty nice. Do you have a great, how's your community there in Dallas?
It's amazing. I started playing towards the second half of 7th, and we didn't have any RTTs. Like, we had 3 in 7th. We've worked to build it up. We now have 3 a month. We have standard events every other month. It's growing faster than I can keep track. I used to run the RTTs, and I don't have time to do it anymore getting ready for this event. And we've had people just volunteer and step in, so it's an amazing community, and it's great to be a part of.
That's pretty cool. So, the culture's there good, so anybody that may be coming from out of town, got a welcoming crew?
Oh, we have extremely. We've had people came from Louisiana and Oklahoma and some other places last year. And some of them started saying, I want to come to all the Texas events because I love playing against these guys.
Man, that's pretty awesome. At this event, there are some other tournaments as well. It's like you got a narrative. What else you got?
We're going to have Star Wars Legion. We have the narrative guys doing a narrative event. And we're going to have Bolt Action.
All right. Well, so some variety. So I guess you got a pretty good size event space.
Yeah, we've got the whole hotel. So I think we've got about as much as I can handle.
What's the bar situation looking like?
The bar is amazing. I've been there twice. it's right in the middle of the hotel. Hard to miss.
Awesome, man. Well, good. It's really nice to hear about some other events happening out there. We may check back in with you as we get closer to this event.
Yeah, please do. I'll try to be more prepared for the interview. If you decide to come down, let me know. I'll buy you a drink.
Man, that's really nice to hear, man. Thanks for talking to me.
Yeah, thank you. And for anyone who didn't get a ticket to Adepticon, same general timeline, just come on down to Dallas, have more fun.
Heck yeah, man. We'll talk soon.
All right, sounds good. Have a good night, Paul.
You're listening to Forge the Narrative.
Hey everybody, we are back. I still got the Baron of the Northern Waste, the Tyrant of the Tundra, the Colossal Falcon, Peter
Clisimo. The handsomest man in 40K. I know.
It's you got okay. An impressive beard, my man.
Oh, thank you. I have groomed it partially for years.
Jealous of your beard and your brain, and Adam the Game Camilleri.
Hello. The Game. I don't mind that.
Duke of Down Under.
Duke of Down Under. I do like that quite a lot, actually.
The Thunder. I'm not gonna Down lie. Under.
The Chunder.
So we're talking
about whoa, no, not like this.
We were talking about that last game, but there were plenty of stories unfolding over the whole thing. We got asked in the chat, like, what the best themed list was, and my man Red Powell had the corn list that was completely divisible by 8, divisible number of units, number of models, pretty impressive. And then there was that all orc buggy list.
Yeah, Chris Fisher. I felt so bad for that guy. He came in, he had won an RTT with that list. Some of his local meta were like Antonio Cedeno, who had been the top Necron going into LVO. He was talking him up to me like, this guy, this list is real. He just has to go first. Of course, his first matchup is against Imperial Fists, and he goes second. And that's probably the worst thing that can happen to him. Like, that basically ends your LVO run right there. So
yeah. I think that player got a little bit lucky against him, too. Like, I was going by, and I think I caught a moment in that game where, like, something happened. He put a bunch of wounds on a Leviathan or something, and then just didn't kill it or something. And so it just ended up beating him up.
But still, like, there were some really cool lists. Like you said, Chris Fisher, and then Red Powell's list was super interesting. The Achilles Ridge Runner list, which was a story that we on and off followed throughout the event. Alex McDougall really carrying that Forces of the Hive Mind. Forces of the Hive Mind had a really good showing at LVO, something that I don't think a lot of people expected because they'd been hit so hard time and again. And Alex McDougall, a big part of that, he went, 5-1, and almost all of his matchups were against Marines. Like, he just couldn't catch a break. So,
He knocked off what a lot of people thought was another big of the international forerunners in, he's got a three-part name.
Yeah, Alcamine Rubio. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Mr. Three-part name. That's what he's going to be from now on.
Mr. Three-part name. you're like Pablo.
He was like, people thought he was going to be the foil to Manny Chambers because he had all the Imperial Fist flyers, whereas Manny had all the Imperial Fist artillery. But that was a big thing for helping a lot of people down the track, because Malik was going to be a big, big trouble for a lot of different lists. In fact, he was a list that could have posed issues to what was eventually the overall winner, and I think that was the Brohammer list.
Mm-hmm.
The Orcs made it pretty deep in the tournament.
Well, yes. Jeff Poole made the top 8, which no one saw coming. I think everyone's predicted top 8 was 5 to 6 Marines, 1 or 2 Eldar, and 1 Chaos. And Orcs making it. It was fantastic. Yeah. We ended up with 1 Eldar, 1 Orcs, 1 Mixed Imperium, and then was it 5 Marines?
Yeah, and that Mixed Imperium was, you know, like 80% Marines with just a splash of Admech for those Scorpius Disintegrators, because they're just so good.
Very point efficient to the killing capacity. So I'm kind of surprised we don't see more of those, I guess because of things like the Imperial Fist exist in such a high volume that they're eventually going to hit a wall. Like they'll be gatekeepered.
Over in Australia they are so I've looked into buying 3 of those, and they are actually just prohibitively expensive. I was like, okay, I could buy 3 flyers for a 2/3 of the cost of 3 of these toaster tanks. Now, I wouldn't, I think I am going to end up buying them, but the problem is the transport that's like, 80 points, 90 points, that transport is the same amount of dollars as the Scorpius. And you're just like, wow, I can't consciously buy 5 of these. Like, I could almost buy an entire another army, or I could buy these 5 tanks.
Yeah.
Mm.
How bad do you want it?
How bad do you want? Not enough, apparently, because I haven't bought them, so.
But yeah, that seems to be like the Admech list right now is, you know, 3 or 4 of those Dune Riders, the transport, and then another 3 of the Disintegrators. So in Australia, you pretty much have to mortgage your house in order to play Admech appropriately.
Yeah.
You also have to buy Blackstone Fortress to get Datalosis, and you gotta, like, it's just a whole thing.
Euculus as well is from another one.
Get that guy from, I think, the Barnes & Noble game.
Oh, yeah?
I think so. I think
you can also probably scratch build him out of a engine seer with a top hat.
Yeah. But I mean, same for Gene Steel Cult as well. Gene Steel Cult has the same issue over here, where it's just prohibitively expensive to to try and build what the list wants to do. The list wants to have, like, you know, sometimes 120 acolytes. It's just, it's like ridiculously expensive. I know we've mentioned that before on this podcast.
I love the models. I actually kind of, for a while there, all the starter sets were coming with Gene Stealer cults. And so if I find like somebody split in a box or something like that for something really reasonable, I just pick up, you know, a unit of Gene Stealers of the cults or whatever. And just, so I've got a decent sized collection. So one day, you know, if I ever get to that hobby project, maybe I'll have a head start.
Yeah. Well, back to Jeff Poole. I mean, did either of you gentlemen have any inkling that orcs were going to do well this event? Because they did. I mean, if you were to take away Space Marines, I think orcs would be almost the next best. I mean, Sean Naden made it an extra round past Jeff Poole, but that's still the fact that that was even a talking point. The fact that I'm even mentioning it right now is phenomenal.
Yes. I had no inkling because orcs had done so terribly into Marines for the last several months. Like, their win rate against Marines was awful. But at LVO, they were essentially the only faction with a positive win rate against Marines. So it was they pulled the opposite.
Do you think that was more attributed to the players themselves?
Oh, for sure. The list? For sure. Like, if you look at who played Marines in that, Anthony Birdsong, who I believe ended up taking number one orcs for the ITC that year, all six of his games were against Marines, and he went 5-1.
Wow.
Jeff Poole, four of his eight games that he ended up playing were against Marines, and he was 4-0 against them. Matthew Hain, I believe, was 3-0 against Marines. Rich Kilton was 2-0 against Marines. So, like, a lot of the best orc players modified their lists to a degree and managed to pull off these wins. I mean, if you talk to Jeff Poole, he's like, I have no idea how I got here. I just thought every Marine player was back in the day. But really, like, if you look at all of those lists that did that well, they actually changed it up. Birdsong, I believe he ran 150 boys, 150 Gretchen, three weird boys, and three shock deck guns. And that's like the whole list. He took out all of the smasher guns he used to run, all the extra tricks. It was just, I'm just going to run like 300 bodies and hope that every Marine player I go up against is gunning for that elite or anti-vehicle list, like most of them were. And then how do you get through that many bodies? You just don't with that list.
I don't have an answer for this, but I think if Jeff was better at clock management, then he might have gone deeper in this tournament.
I agree to a degree, but that's how Sean Naden plays. Like, Sean wants you to use up as much of your clock as fast as possible.
Oh, well, so of course. No, I mean, I'm not saying he didn't have the equitable split of time. I'm just saying that because in that game, Sean was also running low on time. So, I mean, they split the time. I mean, they did it.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm saying it. But if he was better at clock management, I think he outlisted him in that situation.
I don't think you're wrong at all. I felt so bad for Alex Petford in the shadow round because we started on their match and Jeff was like, I'm just going to get blown out because Alex was running a kind of standard Imperial Fist no LOS list, but it was more Thunderfires and quad launchers. So on average, he's picking up like 50 orcs a turn. It was actually designed to kill, you know, massed bodies. And unfortunately for Petford, Jeff decided that a 5-up armor save was the equivalent of a 2-up armor save and just would not let anything die. I think he ended up losing 20 orcs or 23 orcs from all of Petford's shooting into one unit. And then just, you know, green tided them back.
He was like, I got mob rolls and then I'm going to green tide. So
It's so good. So good. But, you know, that's the dice game we play. Sometimes the variance is just there. But I just admiring the fact that these guys had these top players had the cojones to take orcs in this field at all. Yes. I think that's admirable. On top of that, I 100% agree. The smasher guns in ITC missions with Imperial Fists and Marines being a thing, they just can't function. When you have one Thunderfire that can kill like two or three smasher guns, it's just, oh, so ugly.
We saw some Sisters of Battle representation.
Yeah, they were robes.
How deep did Sisters go? I know Gonyo took a prevalence of Sisters, and he did pretty well.
Yeah, I believe Gonyo ended up going 4-0 before he met Brian Pullen, and Brian kind of took him back to Earth. But other than that, let me take a quick gander.
Oh, Alan Majarovic, Pajama Pants?
Yes, Pajama Pants.
Yeah, yeah.
So both Pajama Pants and Ganyo got to the fifth round before they took their first loss. And they, Ganyo was majority sisters. I believe Pajama Pants was entirely sisters.
He was, yep.
So yeah, they were the only two. But they still, like, from a numbers perspective, they did really well. Their average first loss was just after the second round, which is kind of when I do my stats, what I look for a like a balanced semi-competitive army. They actually, you know, had two guys that hit T-Whip in Allen and Ganyo. So, like, they definitely were in that range of being, you know, where they should be for only taking up about 3% of the lists.
Can you explain T-Whip?
Yes, sure. So T-Whip is tournaments in winning position. It's the amount of times that a faction gets to at least 4-0 before they take their first loss. So in most GTs that only go five rounds, if you get to the fifth round undefeated, you're in a very good spot to win an event. And even when you look at majors or super majors, generally the guys that get to that fifth game without a loss, they're the guys that are going to have the best chance at top eighting, etc. So it kind of gives you a good idea, like the amount of people that hit that for a faction compared to how many people play that faction, just how good a faction's currently doing. From the event, to give you an example, Marines made up 54% of T-Web. So 54% of all of the lists that got to 4-0 before they took their first loss were Marines. And they only made up a quarter of the lists.
You actually have T-Web stats on 40kstats.com.
I do. And I'm going to be posting up all these LVO stats on 40kstats.com tomorrow. So it'll have all the T-Whip, everything else people can look and see how they performed. Because I'm going to be doing, like I do every season, a full reset on the stats. All the old stuff will get archived away to theoretically never be seen again, because most nobody ever clicks on the archives. And all the new stuff for the new season will start with LVO and the CanCon stats.
I know you said tomorrow, but by the time people hear this, it will probably be up on the site. So
for
check
sure.
it out at 40kstats.com. The sisters, I mean, that was a kind of a, I guess I did expect to see as many of them as I did. A lot of people had some of the older models, but it was interesting to hear people's talk about like, the Miracle Dice and stuff. I mean, I think I talked to Alex Fennell afterwards. He's like, he rolled some dice, he didn't like the result, and then he got to change them to the results he wanted. I'm like, yeah, that's going to be how what they do. I think that's
yeah, that's cool. Literally all of it. Like that's their shtick. Mm-hmm. It's super cute, that Valorous Heart with the ignore up to AP minus two. If Iron Hands weren't a thing, they would be bonkers. It's just Iron Hands just tear them to pieces because everything they have is AP3. But
Iron Hands are a bit format warping.
Yeah, for sure.
But at the same time, though, if they weren't there, then Imperial Fists would be format warping or Raven Guard would be format warping. I mean, there's and before that, you know, Eldar Flyers were format warping. I mean, there's just we do adapt, and we saw that players do adapt. I think that just people didn't expect the list that won to be there.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's the issue with Iron Hands. The faction, and I'm just going to call it a faction now, because the Space Marine chapters are so distinct and so different, they might as well be their own factions. But I think the issue with Iron Hands is they're so deep that they can run a ridiculously powerful mech army. They can of two or three different varieties, and then they can run a ridiculously potent infantry army of two or three varieties. So they're not only warping in the fact that they change what you take, but they also can adapt to whatever you try and take against them. Because, I mean, initially everyone thought that because Iron Hands had such strong mech in the flyers and the repulsors and things like that, that Imperial Fists were going to stop that and put a stop to it. But then they warp into an infantry list with characters for all the mechs, so it's untargetable. And then all of a sudden, Imperial Fists just don't do enough.
No, and you hit it right there. It's that Faith and Fury book, when it gave the access to the Master Apothecary, completely changed the game for Iron Hands. I think that Iron Hands infantry list was already kind of a thing just because of Pharos, but it wasn't what it was until that 5 plus Feel No Pain, essentially army-wide, because it's so easy to keep in that bubble. Just like tore that. And just, yeah, like you said, Iron Hands can probably make, 9-10 very competitive lists that are mostly different from each other in how they play. Most of the other factions can't. Like Raven Guard, if you want to count them as a supplement, almost, if not just as strong as Iron Hands in terms of like numbers performance, but they basically have one, maybe two lists.
Maybe two. Yeah. The inflexibility, like the internal balance is not there. The internal balance of Iron Hands is just off the charts, even after they've taken successive nerfs. Yeah.
You get endurance and killing, like you're defensive and offensive at the same time. And that's
exactly right.
You know, it's very advantageous to the Iron Hands player.
And we were talking about how, well, I don't want to be disparaging, but Salamanders never got out of the gate in that way. They got out of the gate and they had something that was super, super powerful. They got to play it for like a week and then G-Dub took it away and they've never been able to recover since. Now, internally, Salamanders seem okay, but they don't even measure up to many of the other Space Marine factions when you put them like head to head. They don't even come close. They would have pre-nerfs, but then the pre-nerfs, they were probably on par with where Iron Hands are now.
Well, I think this is all surmountable, though. You just did mention, though, the variance that you have to account for is that, am I going to fight the flyer version? Am I going to fight the Kaplan Dread version? Am I going to fight the 70 Intercessor version? You know, it's all there. I don't know what the answer is, but, you know, I think that the players will crack it. And these players the other players that made it into the top eight had to fight multiple versions of those lists along the way. So, I mean, it's possible. I mean, 40K is still fine.
Oh, yeah, it needs a little tweak. It's definitely not where it was, you know, 3 or 4 years ago when you were dealing with, you know, four lists that dominated the meta and you had to run one of those four. But it's a little rough around the edges right now. Little rough.
Well, I still think it's encouraging the fact that we did see orcs. We did see, I mean, Chaos made it all the way to in round six, there were three Chaos lists undefeated, I think. It was Mark Perry, TJ Lanigan, and there was one more. That I can't quite remember. Mr. McKenzie played on the stream game against the Admech.
No, he had already lost. He lost in round four.
Oh, okay, sorry.
But yeah, no, you were right. There were three that were undefeated going into that round. Actually, I believe one of them stayed undefeated. He went 5-0-1 and missed the cut.
Yes, that's right. Because we had 13 actually undefeated players, and then we had, I think, the 14th player who had just not taken a loss.
Yeah, he was 5-0-1. So, and I wish I could remember his name off the top of my head. I bet I could pull it up, and maybe I will as we keep talking. But okay. Yeah, there was that
was
one
that,
more.
Was that TJ?
No, TJ did make it to the top 12. He lost to Justin Lewis. I have a
shadow round. Yeah. Do you know what we need? Do you know how we have the like Ren Man, Renaissance Man? We need a name for the player, the top player who goes undefeated but doesn't make the cut.
The bubble.
Like, we need a name. So the what?
The bubble. The bubble prize. Yeah.
Aiden Barkley was 4-0-2. Aiden Barkley.
Two draws, wow.
Yeah, he had two draws. And there was one Eldar player that was 5-0-1.
What are the odds of that?
Kyle Perry. two draws don't happen often. I've seen more. I've definitely seen three. I believe there was one this year that had three. And I think Jesse Sell at BAO, when there was that whole issue with Richard Siegler and people thought he intentionally drew his partner, he had like three or four draws that event. And I was like, I don't know if we should be complaining about the guy who had one when there's a guy who just like had three successive draws. And it wasn't his fault. Like I overheard him like joking around with it with people. Like he just couldn't catch a break. But just one of those things. Yeah, there was a person with three draws at LVO as well, but they did not have a good event.
This may just be anecdotal, but you know, while we were calling the games, we saw plenty of what I would consider high point losses. I mean, people were 23, 26 points that lost the game, so people were trying real hard to win this thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, yeah. And it's not anecdotal actually. LVO had a really had a slightly higher average VP, like a victory points for in a game, than most events. It was essentially almost 24-24 for games as the average score. And for a long time, we've been seeing like a 25-22 essentially was the average. So it's unique in that respect.
Well, that's very encouraging for the game that the games are getting so much closer, because that's not what the perception is. The perception is that the game is boiled down to who goes first, usually smashes the other person, like it was at the start of this edition. But the fact that we've got 24-24 being the average score for both players, that's really encouraging, and it goes against that perception.
Yeah, it's good. It is good to see that just even that extra couple points of score that on average at LVO, it's definitely encouraging.
That's interesting. Nice. You may not to Adam, to your point there, and you may not have this stat, Peter, so tell me to shut up if you don't, but have you noticed the game being more defensive, like people who go second, they'll lose less often, or did someone's T-whip change, or an army's T-whip change after like prepared positions became a thing, or you know, those kind of stuff?
Way back when prepared positions came a thing, I did do that kind of a raw check. I haven't really looked at it since. There wasn't much of a change in that regard. And as to first, second, unfortunately, most people don't track that. Even though it is something you can track in ITC battle apps, I know the Down Under pairings guys have tracked it in a few events. But generally we don't see it on the North America side, which it is too bad. It's like the one thing I get asked probably the most is, you know, what's the win rate for an army that goes first versus second or is seized on. So
yeah, pretty neat. I think that we saw a lot of people playing to go second. A lot of armies are designed to go second. So that Adam, to your point, the perception of, well, and you hear this all the time. Well, I didn't go first, so I lost. It's really easy to blame that if you look a little bit more objectively, maybe that is not what the undoing was.
Yeah, I think the advice there is that if you think you're going to get, if you're worried about getting smashed in table turn one, you need to change what you're taking in your list. Like maybe you take a little bit less suboptimal stuff, but that's got a lot more resilience to it. I know things like, I've been talking to Chaos players who are really worried that the Possessed, when they don't go first, just can get absolutely demolished by some armies, especially ones that have flyers, and they can fly over the things that would usually stop you from being able to target them with the Night Lord's trait. Now, I told them, like, why don't you look into things like Beasts of Nurgle? They're ridiculously resilient for their points cost. They don't really do any damage, so people don't see them as a massive threat, but they just all sit there all gay getting your points. And things like that might be the things people need to look into. Just stuff that it might not kill anything, but at least it doesn't die. And not being on the table means you're always in a chance.
Like, the only way that Death Guard strat, you know, that lets them not target certain things. I mean, you got that's an idea.
Well, yeah. While I was talking about the Alpha Legion has one the same thing, yep. Pretty much. Yep. I said Night Lords though. I meant Alpha Legion. Apologies. Oh, gotcha. Yep.
You're the worst.
I am the worst. I'm the worst.
I thought you were good at this.
Why are you even on the show? Get out of
here. Yeah, I don't know. I shouldn't be here. It's because I've got like some kind of moniker, like the Duke or something. As soon as someone calls you the Duke, like, you got to have them on podcasts.
That's it, man. Which one do you like better, the game or the Duke? You can just make it happen.
I think it's the Duke. Duke of Down Under. I think that's pretty good.
John Wayne, man. John Wayne.
Yeah, I know. And exactly right. It's got John Wayne is a boss, and I'll take any associate. I'll take any association.
Talking about Chaos, and Peter, you mentioned 2,000 cultists. That might have been in one list.
Quite possibly could have. No, not this year. I believe there was, I want to say it may have been LVO last year or SoCal last year when I did this. There was a guy that brought like 400 cultists in a list, and I'd only counted like, you know, 800 and all. And this guy was, you know, half of them. This year, not so much. It was mostly 30 to 60 cultists. Possessed were definitely out in droves for Chaos. They were like the big hitter. I think there's 388 Possessed over only 22 lists because people trying to get that bomb.
I cannot endorse the Possessed.
Well, someone did because there's a lot of them. And I think we saw the result. I mean, TJ did very well with them. But he plays Possessed a lot differently than your average person. He's way more cagey. It's a very much a point denial list that wants you to come to them and then it hits you. You saw Mark Perry play it very similarly, except he had a couple more aggressive elements in his version. A lot of the people that run those Possessed, though, they go all in, right? They're like, it's just like, you know, your average Blood Angel player like myself, who's just like, I want to kill stuff. That's why these things are on the board. But that's not how you're supposed to play it. You have to sit back, make them come to you, use every buff you can to keep your guys alive. And then when you hit them and you pull 60 models, it's, you know, that's the game, right? So.
Yeah,
I agree 100%.
I see it.
And the thing is, the game is so, like, the damage output of these super units is so ridiculous there. The ceiling is so high. You don't need to be doing that at turn one. You just need to do it, like, one key turn of the game.
Well, and I suppose the skill. Anymore. Yes. I mean,
Most armies aren't pulling them. And one thing for the Possessed, I'll say, is the average Chaos Space Marine list had about a 45% win rate at LVO. Didn't do too good. Possessed lists that contained Possessed had almost a 55. So, like, they didn't do poorly. I mean, a lot of that's on the back of TJ and Mark Perry, but, I mean, like, they're not slouching. Like, they did okay. No, so
100%.
That's a strong. I mean, Chaos, it's nice to see Chaos still punching, you know, I guess at weight, being a contender.
Yeah. We had a couple of previews, didn't we? Some new AdMech goodness on the horizon.
Oh, my goodness.
Jury's out. I mean, I like the kind of the weird throwback wings.
Yeah. I just want my doggos.
Yeah. You love the doggies. I like the doggies. I don't like the flyer. I know I've been a bit vocal on that, and I've been shouted down many times. But I'm not a huge fan of the actually having physical flappy wings on a flyer. I think that's the step too far. Everything else is fine though.
You're fine with people shooting brain bullets and demons and stuff. But.
Yeah. But flapping wings in the 41st millennium, when they have literally like the next unit over hovers, they hover. They have hover technology. It's in the same product range, but they've got flappy wings.
Hey, specifically at the reveal, they said they don't actually flap and that the designer is furious that people think they do. So
really? Well, they look like they do.
I know. And I'm wondering if that was a mistake. But yeah, they're meant to be gliders, quote, but you know.
Whatever. I think it looks cool. I like the flyer better than I like the troops with the wings.
Yeah, they don't look super good to me. So I wasn't a fan of that.
I've got a couple issues with the troops with the wings. Firstly, they're on those flying stands, which I wish J-Dub would do away with because I've never had a good experience. And secondly, good God, am I going to break those models? Oh my God. They're going to break so much and often.
But the same thing with the Inceptors. I got the name right this time, internet.
Yep.
The Inceptors, people didn't necessarily like the way they looked until they got them in their own hands and were able to do what they wanted with them. So I would, don't discount them. I think they're going to be amazing.
I guess I'm contrary in the fact that I actually don't mind how they look. I don't actually mind how they look. Now that I know the glider, it doesn't actually flap. I don't mind how much that looks either. It's just the concept. if it's built on something I can conceptually visualize, not being ridiculous, even though 41st Millennium is absolutely ridiculous, yeah, I can get behind it, no matter what it looks like.
The sculptor, I believe, has posted some stuff on Twitter, and in the cockpit in there, the flight deck is like really intricate, and all the wires and stuff actually connect into the pilot and stuff.
It's pretty grimdark. They mentioned the pilot for those flyers is actually one of those jump units that have had essentially their legs and arms removed. And their wings are attached to the flyer. Like, I don't know, postmortem isn't the proper word, but whatever. So that's part of where those wings come from. It's the wings off the dude that they shoved in the machine to begin with. But why aren't we talking about the dogs? Cause like, like, come on, guys. They gave us fire breathing robo dogs, and I know they look like horses, but they're dogs, and that's what's important. Cause like, those are the best boys. They're going to be the best boys. I don't even care what their stat line is. So, I'm going to play 9 of them or 100. I don't know what you're
doing. Whatever. What's max unit times 3?
Yeah.
That's pretty cool. So they look weird. Cool.
I'm looking it up right now. But as soon as I saw them, I didn't see an ad mech unit. I saw a Stormcast Eternals unit because, you know, the Chocobo riding Stormcast. Is it the Chocobo ones or is the one that, because there's three different mounted Stormcast units. There's one on the Dracos.
You're not trash talk Chocobos, are you? Because
Chocobos are legit. I'm not going to say this is a bad thing, but all I'm saying is that the stances and the positioning, it really kind of took me to a different model when I looked at it. Because they look very similar. I'm just kind of looking for it now.
It'll be interesting to see how these things either compete or complement the Chicken Walkers for the AdMech range. That's kind of what I'm looking forward to is seeing how all this stuff complements. Because I think the AdMech list is pretty good right now. Like I think that things like Psychic Awakening may even like push it back up into the top. I mean, this is pure speculation. I know nothing of it, but I think it's only right on the threshold of being really good again.
I think they are. I mean, they had a really good win rate going into the LVO. One of the best actually of all the factions over the last couple of months. LVO, they did not, AdMech just didn't perform. And I'm not sure if that's a result of the last couple of books that came in that were allowed at LVO. That we just haven't seen too many tournaments run on, or if it's just a state of the meta with people like, you know, this Brohammer list just wrecking those lists or what. But I believe AdMech have been on the cusp for a very long time. They just need that one little push.
I do think they are a go first dependent army. Like the Cataphrons are, I mean, brutal, like really, really brutal. But it's got that unique combination of going first and being and having juicy targets exposed for them to hose down.
I agree. I think AdMech was a little bit in the same place as things like Death Guard and Thousand Suns and Necrons in the fact that they do have good rules, but they don't have a massive product range. Like they actually don't have a huge amount of good of unit choices. I think like Necrons have the least amount of unit choices of any army in the game, and then T-Suns and Death Guard are T-Suns are the next ones. And then AdMech may have been like this before the Scorpius and Doom Riders and things like that came out. But I like the fact they're fleshing out ranges. Like, I'd love to see Necrons get a handful more units added to their range just to kind of flesh them out. Like, give an alternate, like, Tomblade kit where there's got a close combat variant and a ranged variant. Because that's what they're doing at the moment. They bring out one Vox, but it's two kits. And, like, I 100% agree that AdMech has been on the cusp for a while. And we know that as soon as they got Scorpius Dune Riders, they made a huge jump from, kind of mid-tier to upper mid and maybe even to top tier, but not quite in like the super tier. But, yeah, with these new models, well, I'm pretty excited. Like them getting a legitimate flyer, them getting some, it looks like what's shocking, like, fast, medium cav or light cav to go.
That's
with
where the Rough Riders went.
To go to the Dragoons being the heavy cav. I'm keen. Very, very keen. Now, the thing with AdMech is, I don't know if there's an AdMech player who would disagree with this, but their rules writing has been very, very hit and miss. It's been either, and then again, the points costs have been very hit and miss. Upon release, there were a lot of phenomenal units in the AdMech range, and the points weren't quite right. Like I know Cataphrons and Breaches upon release were prohibitively expensive. Like it was just so expensive to make a battalion with Cataphrons that everyone just had to use Rangers. Now Rangers were good, especially with the arquebuses and things like that.
Yeah, the tools with the sniper rifle set was a 72-inch range, multiple damage.
Yeah, strength 6 sniper rifles, crazy good. And now that those things have come down, like
strength
6
or
like,
7, I think.
String seven, yeah.
Oh, geez, sorry. The points cost never quite measured up to what their output was. And now the point costs are almost perfect for what you get, I think. And breaches might even be a little bit undercosting for what you get. And I'm a big proponent of those. But, they just need one or two or three more decent to good units to give them some tech options to flesh out the range. So when you take your three Scorpiuses and your Onagers and your Breaches and your Destroyers and things like that, you've got your grav bomb equivalent. You've got your suppressors equivalent. You've got your little tech choices
a distraction. Like, so if you've got those Cataphrons on the table, they are automatically target one. You've made your first.
Exactly right.
You've made your opponent's first play for them, right? I think they need a little bit more of a distraction.
Yeah, like as a disruption unit, something you can chuck in your opponent's face and mess with their plans. Yeah.
Speaking of salamanders, a buddy of mine took salamanders just to make it to where you couldn't target those guys.
Yeah, it's perfect. And I mean, Dragoons are very good at that. Infiltrators are now pretty good at that. I mean, Rustalkers are still quite awful. And Electro Priests are the same. But the issue there is they're all quite easy to target and nullify, except for the Electro Priest catching up and get to the 3+ invuln. I mean, I played a unit of 5 and unit of 6 Dragoons for quite a long time until Imperial Fist came out, and then the Dragoons, they just did not do so well. Them relying on the -2 to hit to be their primary source of resilience, and then like Imperial Fist getting the +1 to hit bubble, and then the 4 rerolls, with the Chapter Masters meant the Dragoons just, Stalker Bolters just destroy them. Two Stalker Bolters to kill one 70-point odd Dragoon. That's just breaks your heart.
In that preview, we saw some love getting spread around for Psychic Awakenings coming and touching, you know, every faction for the most part. Looking forward to see what knights and stuff. I mean, these struggling factions, I think I've said this before on previous shows, the rules have proven that they'll push certain factions, certain struggling factions, and hope it's
enough.
You
know what, though? You know what, Paul? I think Imperial Knights deserve to struggle for at least 6 minutes.
Okay.
Give us that. Give us that. They've been so, it's just like Eldar. Eldar have been so strong for so long. The Marine book came out. Literally every Eldar player I knew said it was the worst time of their life. Like nothing worse had ever happened to them than when the Space Marine, because they weren't good, the best anymore.
Yeah.
And then Psychic Awakening came out. All of a sudden they were good again. It was like GW couldn't wait 30 seconds to make Eldar viable.
So at all big tournaments where there's like a water cooler, where people talk about how good and bad stuff is, we need to have like a standing orchestra of people playing tiny violins to just like on cue, just as soon as like goes, I'm playing against Space Marines. I've got this super, super crazy good Eldar army. 1 second, it's bad time. Oh man. And just cue violins. Just all of them just sync up perfectly.
And then take a dollar from them.
I am excited for that engine war. I like the lore behind the new one, the Greater Good. I'm interested to see where this goes with the Tau Guard and Gene Stealer cults. So
there's God.
Yeah, it wasn't Death Guard. You were tricked. It's Astra Militarum, Tau, and Gene Sealer.
Well, color me happy. Any ideas when it's coming out?
Soon. We should see rules here in the next, well, probably this week coming, Monday, Tuesday, and then when pre-order is Friday?
Maybe they'll finally reveal that Arnvald is the Deceiver.
Ooh. What?
The Deceiver, or is he the Changeling?
Look at his feet. He doesn't have hooves.
That's true. It's very true, man. It's actually Alpharius.
I wouldn't put any past that crap.
Giant Primarch. We already saw the new Shadow Sun model, apparently with multiple weapon options now. She doesn't just come with two fusion blasters. You can actually swap them out. So that seems interesting.
That's cool.
I'm really interested with this. I do have a large Tau army that I've largely ignored since the end of 7th because I had so much shame.
Yeah.
I did sell a lot of it, but I still kept more than I probably should have. Yeah, I kept the good parts. I have a number of Riptides in a bag somewhere.
So. well, guys, man, this has been a pretty cool recap, and I appreciate y'all joining me.
Well, thanks for having me. It's my first time on the show. I've loved this show since I started getting into this side of the 40K community a few years back. So it's an absolute dream to be on.
Oh, dude, well, it's been an honor and a privilege to serve with you over this past weekend.
Yeah, and I hope we get to do it again.
Heck yeah, man. Adam, man. You're an old head at this. I'm not throwing superlatives at you. You know I love you.
I love you too, my man. And dude, it was like just getting to meet you after we've shared so many talks, so many episodes of this. It was actually like it meant a lot to me.
Yeah,
and
man, that was great.
And shout out to everybody in the US who made my month long stay there a dream come true. It was actually one of the best trips I've ever been on. And I might have some interesting perspectives upon your nation, but I don't have a single bad thing to say about the people in it. Like, you guys are phenomenal. Thank you so much.
Not even the people at Outback Steakhouse?
Especially not the people at Outback Steakhouse. They are doing the Lord's work.
So you telling me
memes aplenty.
When I go to Outback and I order a large Foster's, that I'm not really, I'm not bonding with you then?
No. We wouldn't drink. I'm not going to swear. We wouldn't drink that stuff if it was like actually coming out of the clouds instead of rain. We wouldn't. Still
I think
wouldn't
it's
drink
brewed
it.
In Canada. I think.
whoa! Don't get me involved.
I think Foster's is brewed in Canada. I could be wrong, but I don't.
Yeah, I believe you're right. I believe you're
right. well, please check out 40kstats.com to find all the numbers that you've been talking about, Peter. They'll be up there for viewing, and you have a volume of other stats. So if people, I mean, numbers are what they are; they're what you make of them. But I think you can really make some informed decisions about what your army should be doing, could be doing, and what to expect from things as you plot your way through tournaments. It's a great service you're doing for the community.
Thanks a lot.
For anybody that's curious about what we were talking about, what we did, that stuff is up on Twitch. You can view it right now under 40K Stats Center, and that's center spelled with an R-E at the end.
The proper way.
Sure. Yeah. And the Ocho, you can find it. Yeah, I think it's worth tuning in just to see what it could be like. Guys, y'all have a great rest of y'all's night.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Make my day.